Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, our old friend Jana Matthews is back. She was one of my very first guests on this program. Jana is professor of medieval literature at Rollins College and the author of a new book about fraternities and sororities called The Benefits of Friends. Make sure you check that out. Then after that, I include an extended conversation with medieval historian Ian McInnes. Ian and I talk about Clash of Kings and House of the Dragon. Just a note, after this season concludes, Aaron will be joining me to do listener feedback. Feel free to send that to book@baldmove.com if you have any questions for me or Bosmang Aaron. All right, without further ado, here is Professor Jana Matthews. Jana, do you have any especially interesting New Year's resolutions?
You know, I went to get my health check this morning, just my annual physical, because I tried to do it at the beginning of the year, and they asked me if I exercise, and I just said, like, aspirationally.
And that's a great answer for that.
So I feel like
it's part of my hopes and dreams.
Right. Sort of tilted her head, and she's like, well, you might want to, you know, translate into reality. And I think, well, you're just probably right.
I kind of feel the same way whenever I go to the dentist. It's like, like, how often do you floss? And I almost feel like just saying, let's just make an agreement. Let's never talk about flossing again. I know that right. I should, and you know that you should tell me to. But this is just the same game over and over and over again.
I know. It's hard.
Hey, I wanted to ask you a question that I've been thinking a lot about this week, and that is, who do you think gets more vitriol from the fandom? Do you think it's Ned or Kat? Because I used to say Ned, and now I think I hear a lot of Catelyn derision as well.
I would actually argue that Catelyn does too, and part of that just might be because she's a woman, and we're, you know, historically and sort of even socially less generous to women than men. But, you know, she's also in the series for much longer than Ned.
Right.
And, you know, she's a mama bear. And sometimes the things that she says and she does might serve her or her children's interests at the expense of quite a range of other people.
Right.
And sometimes that, you know, we've got it. You have to acknowledge that.
So I was talking with my friend Heather the other day, and she was saying that in rereading this chapter, she just feels like Catelyn almost always makes questionable choices. Like she just keeps making the wrong choice over and over and over again. And I wonder if some of that can be explained because her goals are different than other people's goals. Like in this chapter, Rob's thinking, how do I win this war? And Catelyn's thinking, how do I get my son to win this war? But in addition to that, she's also thinking, and how do I get my daughters back alive? And she might prioritize the daughters over the war. So it could just be her priorities are different. And so maybe she is viewed differently.
I think her priorities are viewed differently, and therefore they're viewed selfishly.
Right.
And
I
think that Rob here is, you know, the opening scene has some sort of like fingering and playing around with the crown, and you know, Catelyn's eyes are kind of fixated on that, and she's you could almost like see her irritation as he kind of plays around with it and tries to adjust it, and there's some sort of metaphor for that too. But it's, you know, when he puts on the crown, he is not thinking about he's thinking about the body politic, and that surely involves his family, but it's much more broad than that. Where Catelyn, you know, as a woman and as the matriarch of the family, is her goal and only goal, as she's been raised to think and aspire to, is to have all of her children well placed, either in a place of kingship or mm-hmm. a place of rulership, or position to give birth to a potential ruler.
Right.
And so, you know, she's both responding as a mother, but also as somebody who is trying to gain power from and retain power from a different angle, which is protecting the wombs of her daughters.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the hands of Joffrey, you know, she knows it's just a matter of time until Sansa is, you know, and her children unsafe, and her line are unsafe in that kingdom.
I also think that there's something about her being sort of more aware of Southern politics than a lot of Rob's advisors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like great John Umber, he's kind of like all masculinity all the time.
Yeah.
You know? And then Edmure's a little bit more like, I guess he's a creature of the South too, but I don't feel like he's the sharpest knife in the drawer. Like for some reason, Brendan, her brother, Brendan Blackfish, I feel like he's probably the person that ought to be in Rob's ear, but really he's on the margins. And so Kat gets the benefit of his wisdom. The conversation between those two, Brendan and Catelyn, to me is much more interesting than the conversation between anyone else in this story. But let's get to that in a bit. I wanted to ask you about the crown. I wanted Rob's crown in particular.
Yeah.
I had never paid attention to the details of that before. I think it serves a couple purposes in the story. I think it's a metaphor, right? It's fitting uncomfortably on this boy's head. I think that's the first thing. And number two, I think it's almost like a relic. It's like there was a crown for the Kings of Winter, and it got handed over a long time ago, and so they're kind of trying to replicate what they think it looked like. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I just love that opening scene. And I think that Martin is really sort of the master in every one of these chapters of using those first couple of paragraphs to guide us and identify sort of the symbolic object or thing that he wants us to sort of use as a metaphor for the rest of that, of the conversations that are to follow. Mm. And so he obviously situates us to look really intensely and closely at the manufacture and structure and composition of this crown. And right, I mean, as you pointed out, it sits really uneasily. It's too big for him.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't fit right. It's kind of like wearing a ring that's too loose, and you can never kind of get it, you know, until you grow into it, until your body expands, isn't going to quite fit neatly. And so he's tinkering with it. He's used to the weight of it on his shoulders. And that's a metaphor in itself, like mm-hmm. the weight of monarchy that's on him. I couldn't, you know, you're talking about a sort of as a relic, and I think the relationship between relic and replica are really interesting.
Oh,
here
interesting.
Because yeah. Right, because it is a replica of a relic,
right?
And anytime you make a replica, it always in some senses is a better version than the original because it's new.
Sure, sure.
You know, it
is better technology.
Yeah, but it also it's a forgery and it's a fake.
Uh-huh.
And so one of the things I think that's being asked here is that it's not the original crown that's been passed down. It's sort of the imagined version of what we think that thing looked like from memory or from historical legend. And it's sitting on this individual's head. And you think, well, like, it's not going to go well if you have somebody who's wearing a fake crown.
Yeah,
because essentially that's what's happening. And so it foreshadows, I think, infinitely, not only because it doesn't fit him well, but because it's not real.
Well, that's interesting. From Kat's perspective, the smith who made the crown did a really good job. Like the, mm-hmm. like the smith who did, like the crown looks the part. And the thing that looks off is the person wearing the crown. It's like, mm-hmm. like the person beneath the crown, from Kat's perspective, 15-year-old boy. His voice isn't quite there yet. Like, he's not quite finished with puberty yet. He's intimidating not because he's got this sword, but because he's got this wolf. You know, the sword is positioned perfectly. The wolf is intimidating. Everyone else around the king looks perfect. It's the king himself that's the problem, right?
Right.
So that's Casper's side. Now, you could look at that and think, well, that's how this is the problem between mothers and sons. There's a sense in which you're always kind of going to see the little boy, no matter how big he gets. But I do think that she has the right of it. I think that Rob is going to be easily influenced. People like Great John Umber are going to have some kind of impact on him. And he might have a little bit of false confidence because he has been so successful so fast.
Right. And, you know, this is a story in a series of boy kings. And so we've got him to compare with Joffrey. And Joffrey wears his crown with fear. And even though he is young, when he ascends the throne, it's a very, very different kind of way of occupying that space. If I could bring us back into parallel to history, and again, we want to be really careful that we're not mapping things on, because this is, you know, Game of Thrones is an amalgam of lots of different parts and pieces from history right. All over the place. But I think it's, as I was rereading this chapter, I was really drawn back to the later Middle Ages, and specifically the War of the Roses, which is, obviously Martin's very favorite period in medieval history to kind of like latch onto. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me also of kind of like the real historical precedent behind the figure of Rob. And many people have made the comparison and link between Rob and between Edward IV of York, who was similarly the eldest son of a powerful lord who was killed by his enemies and served as an impetus for the Civil War. Mm. And when Edward IV ascends the throne, the reason why he does that, he crowns himself the king, and his dad, right, Richard, was the hand of the king equivalent, right? He's the hand okay. of the king. And the reason why he got that position of power is because he actually captured the king in battle. And instead of usurping the king, he made a deal with him and said, I'm going to be your hand, essentially, instead of the nice way to put it. Mm-hmm. And then instead of your children ascending the throne, mine are.
Oh.
And what ended up happening is that is where Edward ascended the throne. And it was so he was not of the sort of correct bloodline to ascend. He did so under really contentious circumstances and wore that crown very, very uneasily. Hmm. And so I think we've got a little bit of, if you're drawing the historical parallels there, you've got Rob, who's in a similar position, whose dad has been killed, right? That sort of initiated this kind of precursor to a civil war, right? They've essentially seceded from the Union, if you want to put it in contemporary American terms, and said, we're on our own. We're not going to recognize you anymore. And that in and of itself is a place of tremendous unease. And both of them were about the same age. So they're both late teens.
Yeah, there are a number of parallels there for sure. And I was going to ask you a little bit about sort of historical hostage taking, but let me read my synopsis of the chapter and we can jump back into that sure. topic. King Rob holds court as Sir Cleos is brought to kneel before him. Rob instructs Cleos to deliver terms of peace to his cousin, Cersei Lannister. Notably, Rob omits any return of Jaime Lannister in his terms of peace, but demands the return of his sisters. In Catelyn's view, a sweeter offer might have been more wise, and she tells this to Rob once he has removed his crown. They, along with Edmure, argue over the terms offered. Then she visits her father, who was asleep and nearing death. She discusses Tywin's doings and objectives with the Blackfish. In response, Kat decides to appeal to King Renly and offer him homage. So, Jana Matthews, I asked you to bring an observation and or a question to the table. What do you want to talk about?
So any of those things sound really great. I'd love to talk a little bit more about hostage taking.
Yeah.
Particularly like the terms that Rob sets out in this sort of elaborate letter. A huge portion of this chapter is dedicated to him kind of cataloging yep. the terms that he wants back. And I think we should talk about, you know, what those terms are and why they're interesting and fun.
Yeah, let's do that. So the terms that I can remember that are notable to me are the conditions by which the North will be set free, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you're going to return any hostages that you have. You're mm-hmm. going to not ask any taxation or any service of any of my subjects. Here are the lands that are going to delineate, you know, the North from the South. And that's really the lion's share of the conversation. And then, of course, kind of like snuck in there, like almost like as an afterthought, like, oh, and by the way, Sir Jaime's going to be held in hostage.
Right.
To make sure that Tywin is, you know, has good behavior or something like that. And from Kat's perspective, there's no way Cersei's going to agree to this.
Yeah, there's no way. And I think the other kind of key terms here is that a lot of the terms that he asked for, he wants the North to be independent. And that's part of it. But a lot of the specifics are specific to his particular family. And so he wants his sisters, he wants his father's bones returned to him.
Right. That's a big one.
He wants his father's sword returned to him. And then, you know, and then it kind of goes on to this thing. So there's a lot of like personal requests here, which is interesting because, you know, a lot of that is, it's Catelyn's kind of intervention into these things. Well, it's about honor and sort of the preservation of reputation and processes and memorials that need to have happened. But, it's this fascinating combination of like personal requests that are things that are important to me and my person and my family, and then those that are important to the kingdom.
Right. Don't you think that the, like, one is almost an extension of the other? Like, for instance, like, from this point of view, the Stark the North entire is almost an extension of the Stark family in terms of the history of it. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like that one, it's almost like the well-being of the North is an extension of the well-being of the Stark lineage or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you see in that is sort of this connection between the land, the people, everyone's intermarried. Everyone is, part of this like sort of broader community. And essentially, right, they just want independence. Mm-hmm. But independence means complete and full separation from all of their kind of relatives who are stuck in the South. Mm-hmm. They want back in the North.
And I think that if you were going to fault Rob, the terms of this agreement, I think that Rob has seen that his family is the most important in the North. Mm-hmm. What he's failed to see is that Jaime Lannister is Tywin's heir.
Yeah.
So I think that there's almost a failure to realize that family is going to be as important to Tywin as family has been in these terms to Rob.
I think you're absolutely right. And what you see here is both the ego on display, but also the vulnerability. So the first three terms that are outlined were wanting the siblings back, the bones and the sword, are really reflective of like what they're really worth fighting for. Those are the things that they see are non-negotiable. And again, if this was sort of a real argument, if we were sitting down and we're providing legal counsel to rogue human beings, we might say like, you need to pick your priorities, and the priorities need to be for the, you know, that Joffrey and the Queen Regent should renounce all claims and dominions of the North. And that really should be kind of the point of negotiations. Of what's happening there.
So I think that fundamental to their disagreement is that Rob is of the mind that Jaime is such a valuable hostage that there's no question that a straight up trade with Jaime and his two sisters would be an equal trade. Mm-hmm. And I think Kat would be happy to make that trade. So I'm wondering, historically speaking, is there a gendered value to hostage taking?
Absolutely. Because first of all, women were taken hostage as well. When you think about, Queen Elizabeth routinely, she held her sister hostage for long periods of time. But the difference is that sister was an heir to the throne. And so in both in the Middle Ages and even sort of the eras that existed before and after, it's not that it was uncommon for women to be held hostage, but the terms and stakes of them, like there were very few cases when it was really, when they really had anything to offer. And so most often they were men, and hostages were routinely held. And it wasn't that they were usually kept imprisoned, especially high ranking hostages in really horrible conditions. Often then they were treated quite well. They were educated. Mm. They were given their own kind of set of apartments. And that's why I think Rob and Catelyn talk about their treatment of Jaime and say, well, you need to let him, they tell the messenger, you need to let Cersei know that this is the condition upon which Jaime's being treated. He's being given fresh straw, good food. Mm-hmm. He's very comfortable. There's nothing, we're treating him humanely, with the idea that, and that's sort of a practice of good militaristic strategy, because you know that when your hostages or your siblings or family members are going to be held captive, you want them to be treated the same way. So it's sort of a gentleman's agreement. But so hostages were a sort of standard operating procedure for how you negotiated in war. But right, to answer your specific question, there was absolutely sort of a gendered component to it. And your value was always determined on how close you were to the throne and sort of seats of power. And because women were rarely close to the seats of power, in terms of inheritance, they were inherently kind of viewed as less valuable hostages, with a few rare exceptions.
Right. And you mentioned something there that I found interesting. So you treat these, I guess, elite hostages well, because you're hoping that they will treat your hostages well, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're talking about how well Jamie's being treated. I mean, who knows if that's just rhetoric, but I think that they probably are treating him fairly well. Look at the way Sansa's being treated, you know. Basically, yeah. She's being punished. Every single time Rob does something that angers Joffrey, he has someone beat Sansa. So you kind of see that this is not playing out the way that they're hoping it plays out, right?
Right. I think that so in what Rob does with making these conditions is he's identifying Sansa as being a valued commodity and to the Stark family. And so the Lannisters very smartly are hitting them where it hurts. If he had not mentioned them, then she probably would have been treated better, because they know that she's, you know, not valued and nobody cares if they get her back or not. And so absolutely, I think that what you see is, and ultimately as we think about how the series is going to unfold, or this book, part of playing dirty is what the Lannisters are constantly accused of. And this is another example of what they're playing dirty. They're sort of courtly rules are in the society that you don't abuse or mistreat your royal hostages, and they are.
Right. I was reading this. I couldn't help but think about the Brittany Griner prisoner swap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a very ancient, practice, but we're still doing it today. Yeah. And I couldn't help but think, like, part of the value for Brittany Griner is her celebrity, right? So she's more a more prominent name, and she has political capital because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that's kind of part of Jamie's value too. It's like, kind of remove the gendered part of it that doesn't necessarily map one to one, but Jamie's the Kingslayer. He's the eldest son of Tywin. He's a celebrity. So he does have proximity to the throne, yes. But that's brought him a certain notoriety, and that's part of his value. And I think that kind of pumps up Rob's reputation to have taken the Kingslayer.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what happened during the War of the Roses. When you think about Richard, the Duke of York, when he captured King Henry VI, and held him, essentially held him hostage, arranged this sort of like weird deal where, the power was going to change. But, you know, having your hands on the king or possession over, control over somebody who, a celebrity of any kind,
uh-huh.
In this sense, the Starks their military prowess and their power is based on the fact that they have this, that they've captured this big player in their kind of still sort of nascent stage of their power building here. At least as they're trying to break away and kind of make a big change or bid for power, they need Jaime. They're not ready to let him go, right? But I think to your, you know, circle back to your initial point, when the mistakes of sending this messenger and making these terms are great and numerous. And Catelyn, if she is the one who was sort of driving the impetus for the inclusion of the demands for her children back, really are causing, are short-sighted and cause in opening up a vulnerability to the Stark family that maybe, or that would not have been there if they had done that.
Interesting. We have three more interpretations of the comet in this chapter.
Yeah.
They keep rolling in. It's a flag of vengeance sent by the old gods. So great John Umber. Brendan Blackfish says that his men call it the Red Messenger, but he doesn't know what sort of message it's trying to deliver. The Tullys generally think it looks like a big fish. And then Brendan says that it's a smear of blood across the sky to indicate warfare, and the blood will be shed on both sides.
It feels, what it I think serves is that the world around you and signs and symbols don't have a fixed meaning in any society, including here. And everyone sees in that mysterious, otherworldly astronomical phenomenon what they want to see. And what they want to see always sort of circles back to themselves. You know, the fact that the Tullys see a blackfish, right? It's of course reflecting back on me what I want to see,
yeah.
and what I anticipate or what I want to happen. So, I think it's a fascinating way in which that the comet serves as another metaphor for kind of both the way that prophecy works, but also the way that motivations are sort of driven and people interpret events through their own eyes and through their own desires.
So I know that in the ancient worlds, great doings in the heavens were, viewed as portents, or they have some kind of political meaning usually, the herald, the birth of a great person, we saw with, Jesus and the star. Or, I guess I was also thinking of like Constantine and his vision of the is it the cross or the risen Jesus?
I think it was the cross.
I think he does see a cross. I'm wondering, do we have instances in the medieval period of people interpreting comets and, supernova in that way?
Oh, there's lots and lots of examples of that. I think, astrology was absolutely sort of a form of science, but also like Game of Thrones, right? Science and religion are sort of intimately mixed, and work to serve one another. I think there's examples from Chaucer that we see in some of his the Canterbury Tales of using the stars and using the astrolabes to sort of interpret events. Huh. And oftentimes what we see in literature is the kind of the use of that, but also the making fun of that, the abuse of that particular system. and perhaps what we see here is a version of that too, where, immediately we have, there's no sort of center of authority. Everyone kind of chimes in with their own reading of that, of the comet. What the comet is a reminder, is sort of a mystery, and then sort of the need of human nature to explain the unexplainable or something that exists outside of yourself. That's essentially, I think, what was sort of like hovering in the margins of this particular chapter, where, kingship is directly linked to some kind of divine power. You need to have somebody outside yourself affirm that authority. And one way is to bring a bunch of people together and to like kneel down. The other one is to put on your outfit and your the accoutrements of authority of kingship.
Right.
And the final version is to have this sort of otherworldly validation of your authority.
Yeah, it's funny. Like everyone views the other views as kind of ridiculous superstition, but they kind of have their own like sanitized version of superstition.
Absolutely. That's 100, that's absolutely what's happening. And I think we're going to see that play out in later chapters too, as well.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Notable introductions in this chapter. Tywin's nephew, Kleos. Frey is introduced. And even though he's he's connected to the Lannisters because he's married Tywin's sister's daughter, he looks like a Frey, and Kat notes that. We have mention of Carl Vance and Jonos Bracken and Armory Lorch. So those are some interesting introductions. Interesting departures. I think that we should probably just assume that Kleos Frey is going to leave and bring terms to Cersei, given what happens in future chapters. Book departures, this entire chapter is only a book thing. I mean, we see Rob in various roles as a young king. You know, we see characters being sent off, you know, as envoys. But almost everything about this chapter, the Blackfish being involved, this is all kind of a book-only affair. So I was interested to see how the show decided to kind of delete a bit of this in season two to kind of get to the action.
Well, I mean, Rob shows up in the book with a full beard, and so not the book, but in the film and the TV series, right, and right. So I think they age him a little bit, sort of bring him closer to Cersei.
Speaking of books, I want you to talk a little bit about your new book, The Benefits of Friends, which is now available. Tell me a bit about this book.
Yeah, so this is on the surface, it will feel like a really strange departure from medieval literature, but when you really kind of like peel back the onion, you'll see that the extra has a lot of connections to it. But I, in addition to serving as a medieval professor for the past decade, I've also worked as a fraternity and sorority advisor on campus. And, you know, fraternities and sororities have a lot in common with the Middle Ages. They're single sex organizations, much like nunneries and monasteries that rely upon ritual, and that are sort of deeply based in the sense of community and sort of serve as communities away from communities. And so some of those insights get woven their way into there and in kind of direct or indirect form, but definitely inform my thinking about it. But yeah, so it just came out with UNC Press in September. I'm really excited about it. And I'm currently working on an essay for a medieval journal that kind of explores more deeply the relations, the specific overlaps between medieval literature and medieval culture and fraternities and sororities, and that should come out next year as well.
Thank you so much, Jana.
No problem. Okay. All right, I'll talk to you soon.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
We finally see the fifth king.
Renly, yes. So we got Renly, and Renly's got problems because...
Yes, he does.
You can kind of see that he's sort of a man of the people. People like him. Mm-hmm. He's got something that a lot of the other kings don't have. And yet, he's having trouble making a baby, Steve.
Yeah, yeah. One thing we know, he's not bi.
He's really repulsed by Marjorie.
Yeah, totally. And
I mean, and she's not great looking. I mean, if you think about it.
Yes, she's fine.
No Joffrey, Steve.
No, that's true.
Hear the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move. House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you. In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers. If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur: Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends, and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good. You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war. Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I do have a question about A Clash of Kings.
Okay.
And it's the question about hostages.
Hmm.
It's a really big deal in Martin's world that certain children are fostered in other houses. Mm. And that, especially after some kind of conflict, in order to keep the peace with maybe a house that you're not friendly with, that you would take the hostage. In this case, we see Theon being fosters at Winterfell because it's the oldest son of Baelon. Was that a major practice? Was that a common practice?
I mean, I think that there's two elements to it. So the hostage element, yes, very much so, it is part and parcel of, you know, medieval conflict resolution, or whether that's long term or short term, and in various different scenarios, that, you know, you will ask for or demand hostages, and these will be given as a sign of good faith, and to guarantee that both sides behave as they should in a certain circumstance.
And are these children, these hostages?
Yeah, well, normally yes, because they have to be hostages of value. So either various examples of nobles or their children, or indeed if you really want to pin somebody down, then yes, their own children or extended family. So yes, if it's a lord who's been in rebellion, for example, he may well hand over his son or his sons or his nephews or whatever, because yes, there has to be a subtext there of, if you misbehave again, I can do what I like to your son or to your relative, because you have forfeited their protection by misbehaving again. And that does happen. That there's the Scottish Earl of Orkney, Harold Maddison, rebels against William the Lion, and has to hand over his son as part of the deal that sees him come in to the king's peace. But his son Thorfinn is then kept a prisoner. He's probably kept reasonably well, but he remains a prisoner, and he remains the king's to do with as he wishes, as a means of making sure that Harold doesn't misbehave. But Harold rebels again. And in that circumstance, Thorfinn has his eyes put out, and he's, I think, is he not castrated as well?
Oh my gosh.
And he dies of his injuries. Now, actually, his death is probably not intended. Those types of punishments are intended to be non-lethal. It's meant to be a punishment, not a death.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Did this practice of sharing hostages actually serve its purpose? Did it keep the peace? And it sounds like it didn't always do that.
Well, no, I think it depends on the context in which it happens, and it depends on the relationships that are looking to be fixed. I mean, I think if you're looking for a way in which a conflict can be ended, I would suggest that hostages are less used as a kind of final element, and far more it's a marriage alliance that's then sealed. So if you look at, for example, peace being agreed between Scotland and England in 1328 at the end of the First War of Independence, there is that marriage between the two royal families. Young David of Scotland, the heir to the Scottish throne, is married to Edward III's sister, Joan of the Tower, and that is meant to cement the relationship between the two kingdoms and to ensure peace going forward, because you've united the two families together in marriage so that they're actually then related to each other. Of course, it doesn't work that way. War restarts again 4 years later. But that's what's intended.
Then my other question would be, how long did this last? Like, Theon is kept, you know, until he's an adult. Did this last forever, or, you know, what was the standard on this?
I think hostages, yeah, I mean, they should be kept for as long as the terms of whatever agreement has been made are satisfied. So the one example would be David II of Scotland is captured in battle, spends 11 years in English captivity, and as part of the ransom negotiated for his release, has to hand over a bundle of Scottish noble prisoners. That turns out is mostly, again, the sons of the Scottish nobility, are handed over to serve. And they're there essentially as surety to make sure that he continues to pay his ransom. Right. So while that ransom is still outstanding, those prisoners remain in England. And at least one of them is still there, I think about 7 or 8 years later, when a bout of plague passes through England, and he actually catches and dies from the plague while in English captivity, still as a hostage for his king paying his ransom. Right. So yeah, these things can last for a long time. I think the complexity of the agreement for which they've been given in the first place can often dictate what that is. I mean, you'll also have hostages handed over for quite short-term transactions, effectively,
right.
Just to solve something in the here and now. But once it's been resolved, then the hostages are handed back, or at least the hostages should be handed back.
So if you can capture like a knight on the battlefield, like Jamie's caught, you know, Jamie's and kept alive, you could easily turn around and trade that for someone maybe who's been in captivity for a very long time.
Yeah, you absolutely can. And that does happen, that kind of exchange of prisoners. I mean, Robert the First of Scotland does that in the aftermath of the Battle of Bannockburn, has in his possession some very high-ranking English prisoners as a result of the English defeat, and so was able to exchange them for his wife, his daughter, his sister, the Bishop of St. Andrews, all these people that have been in English captivity for a number of years. Was that 8 years at that point? So, you know, he's able to exchange them. But I think also, I mean, Jamie's perhaps a bit different just because of his value, but somebody maybe slightly further down the scale, what they should have been able to do is go home to raise a ransom. Because, you know, you have to be able to access your money or try and raise that money. But in return, you would often hand over another member of your family as a hostage to make sure that you come back again, either with the money or to surrender yourself back into captivity because you haven't raised it yet.
Huh. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. What a weird world. I mean, I shouldn't say it's that weird. Someone just really recently tried to kidnap the Speaker of the House.
In my
hometown of San Francisco. So, it's another weird world.
I always try and argue to my students that the medieval period is not all that different. We just perhaps perceive it that way. But.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I was going to ask, this whole idea of a Kingsguard, that there's a certain like higher status of knight that really is in the retinue of the king. Is that just a full invention in Martin's mind, or is there some kind of historical analog there?
No, I mean, I think the king has his own household, and the king has his own household knights and his own household foot soldiers as well. You know, you do have those men who are, you know, the king is acting like any other lord in that sense, in that he has a retinue around him. But of course, there's advanced status and that's granted only to a select few who then form that household retinue for the king, for the crown. So I think that there are parallels, certainly. They're not around the king all the time, I would suggest. But yes, the king will provide them with cloaks and with, you know, gifts of clothing, which would signify them as being part of that retinue. So I think that there are elements to it. And then there are later examples as well. You know, you do have the guard, Eka says, that forms those Scottish troops that form a guard around the French kings from the 15th century, that is instituted. They're mostly archers, certainly, but they are created as a kind of specialist bodyguard almost.
Oh, is that right?
For the French crown. Yeah, and that continues as a ceremonial thing for several centuries.
I was thinking it was more of like a nod to sort of the King Arthur's court, where you've got the Knights of the Round Table or something. But I mean, I guess the question is maybe that mythology emerges out of this idea that the king does have his own knights around him.
Yeah, and medieval kings, or some medieval kings anyway, are deeply influenced by Arthurian legend. You know, Edward III of England makes his own round table. You know, he crafts it. He has this huge wooden round table, and some of them will, you know, they host tournaments where they act out various stories from Arthurian myth, where they dress up and take on the personas of, you know, of Galahad or Lancelot or whatever else. You know, they're cosplaying effectively.
Cosplay in the medieval period.
Absolutely, yes. Some of them will see it as, you know, the kind of pinnacle of chivalry of their how they see themselves, right. And how it's the chivalric ideal, isn't it? It's that idealization of this is what we would like to be.
Yes.
And perhaps self-recognition of we're not usually this way, or we're not often this mm-hmm. way, or indeed we're never going to be this. But as with all things chivalric, I think there is always an ideal that the knights will try and achieve, even if they never get there.
It's a little bit like, you know, kids on the basketball court, or kids on the football pitch wearing the jerseys of their favorite celebrity, right?
Yeah.
There's an ideal out there to live into that model of you know, the ideal sportsman in this case, I guess.
Yeah, and that, you know, you can extend the sporting metaphor further. Again, the tournament is almost always what, certainly as it develops in later years, is almost always done before a crowd. You know, it's a popular sport stroke pastime, famously depicted in A Knight's Tale with the crowd.
Yeah,
you know, they are like a football crowd. They're doing chants and all
they're
the rest
chanting
of it. But, you know,
the Queens, yeah, we will rock you, or something.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, there are elements of that are based in some sort of reality. Yes, the whole point of it was to show off in front of a crowd. It was to delight the crowd. Uh-huh. That was part and parcel of what the knights were trying to achieve. They're trying to earn renown. They're trying to become famous. And that's part and parcel of that.
Right. Okay, I have one last show question for you, and you're not prepared for this, so we'll see how well you do.
You do like to put me on the spot.
I do like to do that. So, we both enjoyed the show. Is there one scene that sticks with you? Is there one, like, if you're thinking back on the season, is there one standout moment where you just thought, that was really affecting, or that was really compelling television? That was really compelling storytelling. Is there one scene that sticks with you?
God, I'm not going to struggle to think of something, aren't I?
I'll tell you mine first.
Okay, cool.
All right, so we have Viserys, who is, you know, he's kind of fashioned himself as this dreamer. He's not a mm-hmm. dragon rider very much anyway. Mm. And he's got this legacy as like the king of peace, and he's a little bit disappointed in himself. Like, he wishes maybe he had been tested so that he might have brought glory to his reign. And he even says so much, you know, he's talking with Otto and saying, look, I always wondered what I would have been like if I had been born in a different time, or if I had been tested in a certain way. And then the next episode, he's a really old guy, like really old. And he looks just like a walking corpse.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got that scene where he, like, no one's expecting him to walk into the throne room. And the doors open. And it's just that long, slow, and I think meant to be heroic walk to the throne.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's that bit about, you know, him, you know, telling Otto to stand aside, and he drops the crown, and his brother, in a moment of brotherly love, puts the crown right on his head. I just thought that, for me, that was the most remarkable scene of the first season. That's the one that really got me anyway.
Yeah, no, and Paddy Considine was excellent throughout. Yeah. I thought, but that was a moment to know. I think I thought maybe the clash after the kids have their fight, and after Aemon is maimed, loses his eye, and that fight within the family when Alicent is demanding retribution, you know, and essentially demanding her nephew's eye.
You've gone too far.
Aye. What have I done? But what was expected of me? Forever upholding the kingdom, the family, the law. Will you pull out your order, do you please?
Alicent, let her go.
Where is duty? Where is sacrifice? Is trampled under your pretty foot again.
Release the blade, Alicent.
And now you take my son's eye. And to even that you feel entitled.
Exhausting, wasn't it? Hiding beneath the cloak of your own righteousness.
But now they see you as you are.
And it's all the frustrations born out of that friendship gone astray, but also again of Alison, the mother, protecting or trying to protect her child, and venting about the fact that no matter what Rhaenyra does, Alicent's husband continues to defend her, will always defend her, and that is a frustration. And of course it goes back to the succession as well, and frustration about not knowing what happens next. Otto already has told her, if Rhaenyra comes to the throne, your children will be dead. Yeah. So all of that is playing at the back of her mind. But yeah, it's just, I suppose, Rhaenyra's comment that, that this is the truth of you, I always knew was there, kind of thing. You finally revealed it to everybody else. Mm-hmm. And she means that in a negative way, but then Otto says to her afterwards that, he's actually quite pleased at that he actually sees in her the aggression.
He's proud of her for the very first time.
For the very first time, yeah, because he
now
sees
that I've
she's
seen that
fit
you're
to play the game.
You can be a political animal out there.
Yeah,
right?
just like me. Well, yeah, because he said before, hasn't he, that sometimes she reminds him of her mother, but you don't necessarily think that as a positive. Perhaps that's the point at which
he
finally sees himself.
You don't really know how he feels about his wife, do you?
No, he's not. He doesn't give much away, Otto, does he? But that's the point at which he perhaps sees himself in her, and knows then perhaps that she's fit for what's to come.
Uh-huh. Thanks, Ian. I appreciate your time.
No worries. Thank you very much.